It has been 42 years since these events happened, and I really don't care what the government is going to do if I spill the beans. Sure, I signed that non-disclosure agreement and was sworn into secrecy all those decades ago, but I don't give a damn. I'm 83 years old and have lived a wonderful life, so come and get me. I am ready to meet my maker. With that said, I really doubt it that the Pentagon is going to send a kill team to eliminate an old man who can barely walk a few feet without his cane. Now, I could begin from the top when I started my Air Force career, but all of that is just useless detail. I will, however, give you a quick rundown of my life in the Air Force Astronaut Corps before the important events of 79. After 8 years of service in the branch, I joined the top secret unit of the Air Force in 1971. I graduated its training program in 1972, and was sent on my first space mission in 74 after spending a year and a half doing office work and writing research papers for the Air Force's Orbital Warfare Research Team. My flight history is not really impressive compared to the other Air Force astronauts, but I guess you wouldn't really know that. It's not like you have the flight manifest of my peers to compare with. My service history prior to 1979 was Blue Gemini 26 in 74, Blue Apollo 6 in 75, Blue Gemini 31 in 76, and Blue Apollo 11 in 78. The Blue Gemini missions were essentially boring orbital peacekeeping missions, with us eyeing our Soviet counterparts, while they did the same to us. The Blue Apollo missions, on the other hand, were the exciting ones. These were the missions we astronauts sought for, and I was lucky enough to take part in two of them. The idea of building a moon base always had a certain kind of appeal that attracted us. Yes, that's right. A moon base on the far side of the moon may sound like science fiction to you, but I can tell you now that back in the 70s, we were launching two missions a year to make it happen. Too bad all our hard work went to waste after the incident of 85. But that's not the story I wanted to talk about. No matter how bad the 85 incident was, I wasn't there, and I did not experience its horrors firsthand. It's not my story to tell. However, the one I did witness was equally terrible and horrifying. I still wake up with nightmares of it, and it was my inability to cut away from these horrors that ultimately ended my career in the Air Force. You see, in 1978, after finishing Blue Apollo 11, I was assigned to the latest program of the Air Force's roster, the Orbital Space Barracks, or OSB. Essentially, the plan was to create an orbital base that would hold 6 personnel, 4 of which would be space-trained Special Forces operators from the Army's Ranger Regiment. These Rangers would be trained to conduct spaceboarding operations and zero-gravity combat in closer-quarter environments, with the overall goal of learning how to storm the Soviet space station and secure it within minutes. In an actual operation, we Air Force astronauts would operate the base and maneuver it to intercept the target space station. Then, depending on the situation, we would either hard dock with it or maneuver close enough for the Rangers to don their spacesuits, conduct a spacewalk, and use their specialized equipment in order to forcibly enter the station. Selected as one out of two astronauts to first work in the station, I became the mission's orbital base pilot and was subordinate to Major Howard MacArthur, the mission commander. Joining us were Captain Jonathan Rogers, the Rangers commander, Master Sergeant Gerald Newman, Specialist Ryan Camberlain, and Specialist Andrew Reynolds. On 1979, all 6 of us lifted off from Midway Launch Base in a Crew X-20 Dinosaur and began our journey to the orbital station, which was nicknamed Phoenix. The base itself was fairly big and was made out of 2 Saturn V third stage boosters that were docked and welded together. However, after the first week, I wished it was bigger. Despite looking large from the outside, the inside was a different story. A lot of the space was taken up by maneuvering propellant, which took up 40% of the station. That left us with 60% of space left, with 30% of which used for space, leaving the remaining 30% for habitation. I'm going to tell you now, it wasn't enough. Now, the Air Force did say that they did their studies, and it told them that the space left was more than enough for 6 humans to live in for 6 months. However, with the Rangers always training and the US Air Force personnel zooming about in order to maintain the station, we often intersected one another and interrupted each other's work. It took us a month before we finally got a schedule that allowed the least amount of interruptions. After the third month, with a standard routine made and inter-service friendships created, life in the station was good. But one day, we got a transmission that would bring us into a mission that we trained for, but never expected to actually do.
Pamuk! Pamuk!
The call was garbled, but the one word was clear. Having studied Russian, I knew that it was a cry for help. As part of our mission, the station regularly monitored Soviet space communications. Because of this, part of my schedule was to spend 3 hours in the communication station listening to Soviet chatter. Switching through the various known Soviet frequencies, I recorded everything that I heard before filing them and making use of our latest communication encryption system to transmit the info down to Vandenberg Air Force Base. On that day, I just switched our radios to tune into 121.75 MHz, a frequency we knew that was used by the Soviet orbital piloted station 10, often referred to as Almaz 10. Stunned by what I heard, I quickly called Howard and gestured him to put on his headset to listen to what I was picking up. Just as he did so, the same cry for help repeated.
Pomosh, pomosh.
The last call was cut off, and after waiting for 10 minutes, no new transmission came. We better contact Vandenberg and inform them of this, was Howard's only remark, and before long, we got a reply from them. Information received, Phoenix. Continue to monitor the Soviet frequency and update us of any new developments. So, we did. But there was nothing new to report. After an hour with nothing new happening, it ended up that it was Vandenberg that was going to update us. Phoenix, this is Vandenberg. Do you copy? Vandenberg, this is Phoenix. We copy, Howard replied. Phoenix, it seems we have a request from the Soviet ambassador in Washington, who passed on a message from their Ministry of Defense. Apparently, at exactly 10:21 GMT plus 3, the Soviet Space Force received a distress call from their Almaz 10 space station. This is the same transmission you intercepted. The reason for the distress call is unclear, and they were unable to get any relevant information from the operator's panicked cries. At 10:23, all communications from Almaz 10 was lost, and the Soviets were unable to get vital signs from any of the 6-member crew or telemetry from the station. Because of this, they fear the worst. Due to the direness of the situation, and because there are no nearby Soviet spacecraft to aid Almaz 10, the Soviets are requesting our assistance. They are aware we have a spacecraft in an orbit close to that of Almaz 10, and that's you. Because of that, they are requesting that you rendezvous with the station and conduct a visual inspection. If you can, they want you to dock and assist their cosmonauts in peril. Damn, I said under my breath. They probably concluded that we have boarding equipment here. They are also reminding us of the rescue agreement in the Outer Space Treaty, and they trust that we abide by it. And they mean every part of it. They specifically emphasize the part where we rescue their personnel and that we return every part of their space vehicle. We ran this through with the Pentagon, and they agreed that we should assist the Soviets and rescue their cosmonauts. They also informed us that no attempt to steal Soviet technology or equipment should be made, or else risk backfire. So, take nothing but pictures. Because of these sudden events, a plan for the operation is currently being drawn up, and we will brief you about it within half an hour. Over. Roger that, Vandenberg. We are aware of the situation and will go into high alert. Over, Howard replied, shaking his head. Risk backfire, huh? He muttered, turning towards me. The ambassador probably hinted that they knew we have nukes in some of our stations up here, and threatened to reveal it to the UN if we don't abide by their request. Well, those nukes are only there because the Reds did it first, I had pointed out to him. Which we still failed to confirm, Howard reminded me. Aside from Soviet transmissions mentioning their nukes in space, we are yet to have physical evidence of them existing. The Soviets, on the other hand, probably have photos of our nukes, especially after our careless installation of them in Freedom Station. They've probably been holding back this information until the right moment, which seems to be now. I nodded my head. He was probably right. But after a few seconds, I started wondering about the whole situation. "It's strange, isn't it?" I asked him. "What's strange?" Howard replied. "The Soviets blackmailing us? I think that is a pretty common occurrence." "No, not that," I scoffed. "I mean, the request for help. The Reds must be really desperate if they're asking us to help them." Howard just shrugged. "Maybe," he said. "Then again, maybe they just care a lot for their cosmonauts. I just hope that, if something like that happens to us, the Air Force would show the same care in their hearts, which I doubt." With that, he made his leave, floating away to inform the Rangers of the situation. We worked fast, so that within 3 hours after the briefing, we were approaching Almaz 10 and preparing to dock with it. Almaz 10 was a big station. Do you know Mir? Well, imagine that, but 2 times bigger. Built as a modular-type station, Almaz 10 had various sections popping out in all directions, making the whole place look like an orbiting housepipe system. The station also had various docking ports used for a large variety of roles, from crew entry to resupply operations. The docking port connected to the main command module was our target entry point. As the station's pilot, it was my job to perform the docking maneuver, which I did from a canopy located near the main docking port. This was a delicate task, and one wrong move could end up with us slamming into the Almaz 10, which in turn would result to damaged equipment, concisions, and a large number of hull breaches and leaks in the station's body. Because of this, I had to be very careful. Luckily for everyone, I'd spent countless hours in the simulator back on Earth, practicing for this very moment. In addition to that, I had 2 successful live docking actions over the past 3 months. It was safe to say that I was no rookie, but there was no excuse for me to be careless, since anything could go wrong during these maneuvers. Carefully controlling the stick with my gloved hand, I leaned a bit forward to conduct a visual check on how close we were. In doing so, I accidentally bumped my helmet on the aluminous silicate glass pane of the canopy. I muttered a curse at this, feeling a bit stupid. Working in our spacesuits was hard, especially when you had to do a delicate task as docking. The suit, large, bulky and cumbersome, was not exactly something you wanted on when you needed to do fine control movements. However, protocol was protocol, and we had to have them on. When the procedure for docking with the Soviet space station was planned out, the authors had it in their minds that we would be facing a hostile target, one that would be firing guns or missiles at us. In that scenario, a single hit would rip a hole in the Phoenix and decompress the air out of the station. If that happened, then it meant death for anyone who wasn't suited up. Thus, it was necessary to have everyone on board wearing their suits. Of course, given the actual situation we had at the time, our target station was not supposed to be hostile. But headquarters feared that the Soviets had an onboard artificial intelligence on their station, which would automatically lock on and engage spacecraft that it did not identify as friendly. With the Soviets having lost telemetry with the station, it was unknown if this system was still active. So, as a precaution, we were required to have our spacesuits on. As we got closer to Almaz 10, however, it became evidently clear that the station's defense system was no longer online. Then again, I'm not even sure if the station even had an artificial intelligence handling its defenses. Although, I can't be sure. They never really declassify this stuff, you know. Happy with the knowledge that no one was going to shoot at us, I continued my work and got the Phoenix docking port aligned with that of Almaz 10. Keeping it aligned on the right target, I brought the docking port closer and closer until the gentle sound of metal bumping echoed along the hull. Achieving a soft dock, I then flipped a switch to allow the mechanical clamps to grasp the Soviet station's port. Getting all green lights, I informed Howard that we got a good hard dock and was beginning the pressurization of the hallway that connected the 2 ports. Once this was done, the Rangers would begin their task of entering Almaz 10 and assist the Soviet cosmonauts on the other side. Joining the Ranger team at the hatch of our docking port, I monitored the pressure levels of the hallway as the Rangers prepared themselves and checked their gear. Going through their own intricate set of checklist, they checked and double-checked everything, from suit systems to weapons. Yes, I know what you're thinking. This was supposed to be an aid and rescue mission, so why the need for weapons? Why, for safety, of course. It is true that we were here to help the Reds, but help them against what? For all we know, there could be a crazed cosmonaut on the other side, floating around and killing his crewmates because he could not stand another day in the cramped station. That was a possibility, and headquarters knew that. So, in order to protect ourselves over such a possibility, the Rangers would go in with weapons armed. In fact, even we astronauts were ordered to carry our guns, just in case we needed to use them. Only when it was confirmed that the situation was safe would we and the Rangers put our safeties on and stow away the weapons. "Hey," Jonathan said, his voice blaring in my earpiece as he used the local comms network. "You checked your weapon yet?" Turning to him, I noticed that he was done going through his checks and was now facing me and gesturing to the holster on my suit's belt. I glanced at him before shaking my head. "Yeah," I told him, "just before I went to dock the station." "All right," he said, "but be sure to check it again. You'd be amazed how many times weapons fail when you need them the most, so it won't hurt checking them as many times as possible." Nodding my thanks, I carefully took out my pistol from its holster and did the necessary checks. The gyrojet pistol was the standard arm for Air Force astronauts, with the Mark 1 51 caliber pistol being the only one commonly given to us during missions. Firing a rocket-propelled bullet at 1,250 FPS, it was essentially the premier firearm used in space. It gave us the same power normal firearms gave, without the annoying recoil. In zero gravity, that means a lot, since recoil can fling a person from one side of the room to the other. The Rangers carried a similar weapon, the Mark 1 gyrojet carbine, which was essentially the same mechanism, but with a stock and better sights. Once all the checks were done, and that hallway was confirmed to be fully pressurized and without leaks, Howard came to join us and see the Rangers off. Opening the hatch, Captain Jonathan and his team were just about to float across the hallway when a loud and eerie bang reverberated from the other end of the Soviet station's hatch. Thud, thud, thud. "Did you guys hear that?" Specialist Adrian said. He was at the head of the group, assigned to take point, and was about to head for the hatch when the knocking started. Thud, 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 thud. There it came again, this time louder, faster. It sounded frantic and desperate. "Damn," Specialist Andrew cursed. "Those must be the cosmonauts. They must be knocking for help." "But why?" Adrian asked. Sergeant Geralt, who'd been silently contemplating and listening as the knocking happened, was the next to speak up to voice his opinions. "Maybe they're running out of oxygen in there." A silence met the statement as everyone in the room felt a sense of dread fill them. The very idea of running out of oxygen in space would send chills to any spacefarer's bones. To try and breathe and breathe, only for nothing to fill your lungs. Thinking it now still makes me choke up. It's a terrible way to go, and the whole ordeal was something like torture. Suddenly, another batch of knocking came, this time even louder and numerous than the earlier ones. Thud, 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 thud. Unlike before, however, the banging didn't stop. It continued and continued, no ceasing and only increasing. It started to sound like more than one person was knocking now. Now, at that moment in time, I really believed Geralt's conclusion was right, since it made a lot of sense. A micrometeoroid must have punctured the station's hull and drastically depressurized the cabins. That would explain why the distress call hours earlier was frantic and why it was suddenly cut off. However, thinking about it decades later, it should have been obvious to me that it didn't make total sense. If they were indeed running out of oxygen, then how come someone was knocking on the hatch right now, many hours after the distress call was made? Sure, maybe some of them managed to don their spacesuits and hold out for a couple of hours, but then that opens up another question. Why did the station go silent? If a cosmonaut or a group of them did indeed manage to survive the station's loss of oxygen, then how come none of them bothered to contact their ground stations? It didn't make sense. But back then, during the moment, that was none of our concern. We were more worried about the lives of those on the other side, and we wanted to save them. Adrenaline and our own fear blinded us. A sense of urgency now filled us, and thinking that the cosmonauts were indeed choking on their final gasps of air, we decided to quickly open the hatch and help them. "Get that hatch open," Jonathan ordered his team. "Adrian, Geralt, you two get the hatch and open it. Pull whoever's on the other side and get them some air to breathe. Andrew, you stay with us. You and me are going to cover them, just in case those Ruskies are playing us and do something funny. Move." I remember thinking how foolish he was for saying that. Cover them? Against what? Of course, I did not bother asking him that right in his face, but it seemed really unnecessary. I guess you could never just get rid of that soldier's instinct. In the end, it turned out his instinct was right. Quickly flinging themselves across the hallway, Adrian and Geralt reoriented themselves so that their boots made contact with the hatch and absorbed their forward movement. Their impact made a loud thump on the hatch, which seemed to attract the attention of those on the other side as the banging continued to increase. I started feeling uneasy about this. The knocking was very eerie, and having its sound vibrate across the docking fort made me feel unnerved. There was just something about it that was scaring me. Maybe my mind was imagining myself in that situation. Maybe it was the thought that someone was dying there so close to rescue. I did not know what it was at the time, so I never realized that it was actually my flight or fight senses warning me of the imminent danger. Wasting no time, Adrian immediately grabbed the lever for the hatch and used all his strength to pull down the tight mechanism. Once it opened, however, the sight I saw was not what I expected. What I expected were thankful cosmonauts rushing in and grasping sweet breaths of air. What I saw was the face of terror rushing in to spread its vile darkness. Hollow, empty eye sockets, wide, open mouths that clearly indicated a broken jaw, torn and tattered jumpsuits, rotting flesh that exposed muscles and bone, and a thick black liquid oozing out of every orifice and opening in their bodies. That was what the cosmonauts looked like. That was what was left of the cosmonauts. At first, I thought they were corpses. Dead, lifeless corpses. Well, they were indeed dead. Lifeless, though? I am not sure I could say that. The first one lunged through the hatch, just as it was opening and barely one-third done. Its hands, or muscle-wrapped skeleton that resembled a hand, darted towards Adrian and quickly caught his leg. There was no saving him as he was pulled towards this creature, as more hand-like appendages grabbed a hold of him and pulled him inside their Soviet station. "What the hell is that thing? Damn it, get it off of me! Captain, it's pulling me in!" came Adrian's cry on the local comms network. I remember seeing his helmet bump under the barely open hatch as his screams of panic and cries for help continued to echo in our comms. "Hold on, kid, I got ya," Geralt said, as I watched him make a grab for the Ranger. However, the pull by these creatures was too strong and quick, and Adrian disappeared into the darkness of the other side before Geralt could do anything. "Damn, I can't see in here," continued Adrian's calls. "I can't switch on my light. Damn, it's too dark. I think there are more of them. Damn it." I could tell that Geralt was contemplating on rescuing his teammate, as he seemed like he was orienting himself to slip inside. But before any attempts to go in for a rescue could be done, a lunging hand made him think twice. Surprising him, the hand made a grab for his arm, causing him to react and back away. Following his survival instincts, Geralt used his legs to kick the nearby wall and fling himself back towards where we were. Taking his carbine, he then aimed towards the creature that tried to grab him. By then, the creature was using its hands to scoop up air and swim his way towards Geralt. Bits of flesh and muscle were flung off as it did this, as a trail of black liquid marked its path as it moved. Being careful not to hit anything important, since the gyrojet's bullets could easily penetrate the station's hull, Geralt fired two shots. Both rocket-powered bullets were true to the mark and hit the creature's forehead, but it did nothing but leave a large gaping hole that revealed brain matter. I stared at this hole as I felt fear fill my body. It just survived the 51 caliber bullet to the forehead, something that should not have been possible. These bullets were able to penetrate body armor and spaceship hulls, yet the creature went on, unfazed by the gaping hole in its forehead. Whatever this thing was, it was not something that mere bullets could stop. But that did not stop us from trying. Watching the creature approach and seeing the danger it posed to Newman, Jonathan immediately ordered Andrew to cover the sergeant's retreat as he lifted his own carbine and opened fire. Taking precise shots, the two of them fired and fired, the sound of the rocket-powered bullets whizzing through the hallway, echoing through the module. Each hit met its mark, taking chunks away from the creature's head. However, it did nothing to stop it. On it went, swimming its way through the air, dead set and getting to Newman. Luckily for the sergeant, the kinetic force of the bullets was enough to slow the creature down, giving him enough time to reach our side. Getting close, Andrew grabbed Newman by the arm and pulled him in. Falling back, the two were covered by Jonathan as the officer continued to fire at the creature. Once again, it slowed it down. By then, the thing had no more head, with only a disgusting ripped mess left between its shoulders. A trail of flesh, bone, muscles, brain matter, and a black liquid floated behind it, a testament to the ranger's accuracy. Too bad it did nothing to stop the thing. "Close the hatch," Jonathan said as he reversed and tapped me on the shoulder. This brought me back to reality, as I realized that my fear had gotten to me and left me frozen. The sight of these horrible creatures and the sound of Adrian's continued struggling in the comms had essentially paralyzed my mind and left me as nothing but a frightened onlooker. Cursing myself for my uselessness, I grabbed the handle of the latch and pulled onto it to close the entrance to the hallway. Pulling the lever, I locked its mechanism, which was confirmed by 4 firm clicks. But just as the hatch locked, the sound of a loud bump echoed from the other side. Thud, thud, thud. The creature was there, and it was knocking on our hatch. Mustering all my courage, I placed my head on the small window of the hatch and peered out. What I saw was the creature's tattered neck, black liquid oozing out of the tunnel that was supposed to be the esophagus. Puking it out, the liquid floated freely in the air of the hallway. Staring, I noticed that it was some sort of thick dark vial that looked more like jelly when up close. It floated carelessly and without reason, before clumping up together. As if each drop had a mind of its own, the liquid did its best to squirm and make its way towards me. Choosing me as a target, the liquid swam towards my direction, only stopping when it splattered itself on the aluminous silicate material of the window. Backing up, I shook my head and stared at the now covered window. "What the hell?" I sighed under my breath, unable to process what I just saw. However, there was no time to think, as the silence was broken by the sound of Jonathan contacting Adrian through the comms. "Adrian, this is Jonathan. Can you hear me?" There was no reply. "I repeat, Adrian, this is Jonathan. Can you hear me?" Only static replied to him. And for a moment, I thought the ranger was a goner. What a terrible way to go, to be killed by those creatures. I can only imagine what horrible things they did to him before he finally succumbed to their assaults and died. "Adrian," the ranger officer repeated. "This is Jonathan. Are you there?" Damn it. The whisper-like curse came through the comms, and suddenly hope filled us all. The sound of heavy breathing then followed, as more curses bombarded our comms. We weren't sure what was happening to Adrian there on the other side, but at least we knew that he was still alive. "Damn, Captain," he managed to say, still breathing heavily, but sounding much calmer than earlier. "Captain, I need help here." "Adrian," Jonathan shouted, relieved that he had not lost the ranger yet. "Give me a quick sit rep, Ranger. Just hold on there, alright? We'll get you out of there in no time." Then, floating towards one section of our station's wall, he stared at the stolen Almas 10 blueprints we had on board for the ranger's training. "I'm not really sure where I am now, sir," Adrian said, the fear evident in his voice. "I think I might be in the main lab, but I'm not sure. I got lost and disoriented when I tried escaping those things. I'm mostly alright though, sir. No damage on my suit." "Alright, that's good, Adrian. Just hold up in the corner and stay there. We're going in there to get you out." As he spoke, Jonathan studied the map. He was probably formulating a quick plan, Okay, sir, but get here quick, Adrian said. I don't know how long I can... Damn, they're here. Adrian, just stay calm. We'll get to you, Jonathan told him, before turning towards Howard, who was busy communicating to Vandenberg the events that just transpired. Using a secure comms network used by his officers, he began telling us his concerns. Howard, we need to rescue the kid. The lab is only 3 modules away from where we're docked. If we go in there now, we might just be able to save him before he gets overwhelmed. I'm sorry, Jonathan. I don't think we can do that. I just got off with headquarters, and they're ordering us to just undock and get away from here, Howard replied. Undock? Jonathan said with anger. Are they aware that we have a man left behind there? Yes, Captain. They're quite aware that Specialist Chamberlain is still in there, but they have considered the situation, and they do not believe that one man is worth risking the whole team or this valuable station. One man? Jonathan hissed. He is not just one man. I'll never leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. That's the Ranger Creed. So, we're going to go in there and rescue him. Do you think that's a good idea, Captain? Howard asked. How about those creatures? How do you plan on dealing with them as you rescue your fellow Ranger? Clearly our bullets don't work. You would know. You shot at them yourself. We'll find a way. We Rangers always do, Jonathan said firmly. As the two were arguing, I could hear the frantic and desperate calls of Jonathan on the other frequency. I knew those two were hearing the same thing, and I always liked to believe that this brought more urgency to Jonathan's side and guilt to Howard's. They're all over me, Captain, Adrian shouted. I can't fire them. Damn, my bullets aren't stopping them at all. There was a pause, and all I could hear was his heavy breathing. Damn it, I think one of the bullets is stuck in the chamber. The bullet must have been a dud. Damn it, they're closing in. The sounds of a hard struggle could then be heard as Adrian's cries continued. They got me, Captain, help, they got me, where are you? I can't get them off, damn it, they're tearing open my suit, they're shredding it to pieces. By now, Jonathan had given up an argument with Howard and returned his focus on his stranded Ranger. Adrian, we're on our way, just hang on, Jonathan said, ignoring Howard. Geralt, Andrews, we're going to pick up Adrian. The moment I open this hatch, I want you to shoot up that thing that's been banging on a door. You got it? They gave simultaneous, yes sir, as they followed their orders. Floating towards the hatch, Jonathan placed his hands on the lever, ready to unlock it. But before he could do it, I made a sudden and quick decision. Knowing what awaited us if the hatch was opened, I did what I thought, and still believe is right. With one flip of the switch, the clamps holding Phoenix with Almas 10 immediately let go. As I pulled on the stick to push our station away, a whooshing sound could then be heard on the other side of the hatch as the pressurized section was suddenly forced to vent out the air. Then there was silence. The steady thud that reverberated from the hatch had stopped. What have you done? Jonathan asked me, a rage more intense than anything I'd seen before, or would ever see again, ringing in his voice. I don't know. We would have died. The creature was still on the other side, and we wouldn't have been able to stop it. I tried to stammer the right words, but I could not. I knew that I saved our lives by doing that, but I also knew that I may have condemned someone to their death, or a fate worse than death. Jonathan stared at me and seemed ready to kill me, if it weren't for the sound of Adrian's voice interrupting the anger he was feeling. Captain, what just happened? He asked. One moment and those things were all over me, and the next thing I know they were being sucked out of the module we're in. I would have been forced out too if I didn't grab onto one of the handles just in time. Adrian, Jonathan called, relief in his voice. To be honest, I was relieved too. He was alive. I didn't kill a man. What's your situation? Are you all right? I could be better, sir, but I'm mostly okay. I managed to patch up the tear they made with some duct tape, and suit pressure is starting to normalize. It's a good thing they made these things standard issue, Adrian said with a chuckle. Anyway, sir, when are you guys going to pick... Oh, no. Ah, damn it. Adrian, what's wrong? There's something in my suit, sir. Damn it. I can feel it inside my suit. Some kind of slimy goo. Damn it. I don't know what it's doing, but I can feel it moving inside. Damn, Jonathan cursed, turning towards me. Dock this station back on the Elmers. I stared at him. There was no way I was going to do that. I realized what Adrian was talking about. It was the black liquid. I did not know much about the black liquid, and I still don't know much about it. But what I did know was that it was alive and deadly. "I can't do that," I simply told him, trying to hide the guilt I was feeling. It was then I realized that I didn't save Adrian from death after all. The black liquid is clearly still in the station, and we're risking infecting ourselves if we go back there. I felt cold and heartless saying that. And yes, the guilt got to me. But I was trying to keep us all alive.
"Damn it,"
Jonathan cursed.
"It's trying to get in me," cried out Adrian. "Damn, I can feel it slipping in. Captain, it's going in everywhere. Some of it's crawling on my neck. Damn it, I can see it now. It's moving into my mouth."
Gagging sounds then filled the comms as Adrian struggled to breathe. I can only imagine how terrible the experience was for him. Just then, Jonathan did something I did not expect. He raised his carbine and pointed it at me. "Dock this station now, or I'll blow your head off."
"Whoa,"
I said, shocked and frightened. "Okay, Captain, let's try to calm down. Think about what you're doing."
"No,"
he said firmly. "There won't be anything calm until we have Adrian back on board, so dock this station now." "Captain, you'll be arrested if you don't stop now," I reminded him. "I'll be arrested when we get back on Earth, but at least I'll have saved one of my men, so dock us now." Staring at him before glancing at his carbine, I knew that I had no other choice. Reluctantly, I turned toward my console. I felt angry though. This man was going to get us all killed, and he didn't realize it. In the background, the sound of Adrian struggling could still be heard.
"Dock us quickly, we don't have time to spare,"
he told me, before changing frequencies to talk to Adrian.
"Just hang on in there, kid. We'll be there."
Whatever he had to say was cut off by three spurts of rockets firing. Confused, I turned towards him, only to move back in surprise. His helmet was covered in blood. I cursed before noticing that Geralt and Andrew were in a similar situation, helmet visors covered in blood. Right in front of me were three floating dead bodies, and behind them was Howard, gun drawn and face expressionless. In the urgency of the situation, he'd slipped behind them and resorted to the quickest method of dealing with a mutiny.
"Damn idiot," he muttered. "Should have just listened to me and followed orders. This is going to be one hell of a mission report we'll have to file later."
"Did you really have to shoot Geralt and Andrew too?" I asked. Howard shrugged. "It was necessary. They would have retaliated so they could avenge Jonathan and save Adrian. He should have just followed orders instead of throwing a tantrum. Then maybe he would still be alive, instead of dying a disgraceful death." I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say. Instead, I just stared, while in the background, the muffled voice of Adrian still blared in the comms network.
"Captain, are you there?"
he said. But there was no reply. Jonathan and his team were dead, and Howard had no plans of talking to the man he planned on leaving behind.
"Captain, I don't know what's happening, but I feel strange. I don't feel all right. I feel hungry."
The next couple of minutes was filled with the sounds of Adrian growling before being cut off by the sound of rushing air. My assumption is that he took off his helmet. Why he did that, I don't know. And I don't ever plan on knowing. We spent the next hour cleaning up the mess and debriefing Vandenberg of the situation. As we did so, I could still see the eerie sight of Alma's tent through the various canopies, and I swear that I saw some of those creatures floating and drifting in space. Once everything was clear and all the information we needed was gathered, we were ordered to conduct an orbital maneuver to a lower parking orbit. The Soviets, we were told, had been informed of what had happened and would be taking over recovery operations. Why they wanted to recover the station, I didn't know. But I was glad that we were finally getting away from it. The next day, we were ordered back to Earth, and the moment we landed at Vandenberg, we were immediately quarantined and interrogated for every bit of information we knew. We cooperated, of course, and after 2 weeks, we were cleared off. After such an intense encounter, it was decided that we should remain grounded for a couple of months. To be honest, I was glad for this. For 13 months, I was assigned to light duty, conducting research and paperwork. I never saw Howard again after that, but I heard he was immediately sent back up after 3 months of rest. After my time of light duty, I was ordered to have a psych evaluation. Apparently, they needed a good pilot for a planned 1980 mission to Mars, but after my experience the last time I went up there, it's no shock to say that I failed. I was still too traumatized, and they concluded that a 6-month voyage in a spaceship was no place for a man like me. Sick of research duty, and with no future prospects of going up, not that I would have wanted to, I finally decided to quit the Air Force. The next few years were tough, but I did my best to hide my fears and guilt from my friends and family. Nightmares always plagued me, and regret would suddenly hit me at unexpected times. The events of 1979 at Almaz 10 would never leave my memory. I know that I will continuously be plagued by terror, brought on by its horrors and the regret I feel because of my decisions. However, I do hope that by putting this out there, the weight I feel will be lessened. To Adrian, if you're still up there, I'm sorry for leaving you behind.